on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. So much to get to from the weekend. The Red Sox mop the Yankees at Fenway. Rangers mop the Blue Jays. The AL East is absolute chaos. We also bring on a special guest, Sam Blum of The Athletic, making his Baseball Barbacast debut to react to the big news that the Angels have fired their general manager, Perry Minasian. Where does this dysfunctional franchise go from here? Can John Mozeliak lead them into competency? All that and so much more on this Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world thinking about what a life it must be for a four-day-old Red Sox fan. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and that little newborn nugget knows nothing but winning.
Only knows joy, yes. And, you know, it's good because on Sunday Night Baseball, that four-day-old Red Sox fan did get to experience some Red Sox pain at the end of that game, thinking, oh, my God, what a cursed existence this is. And yet they still managed to find a way to complete the mop of the New York Yankees, the first mop of the Yankees by the Red Sox since 2018, which is, of course, you think it's ancient history to us. Imagine how the four-day-old Red Sox fan feels. It was a wild weekend of baseball, particularly in the American League East, and that is going to be our opener.
Not often do we get a weekend mop. Not often do we get two weekend mops. And oh, so rare is it when two of those mops happen in the same division at the same time. We had the Boston Red Sox mopping the Yanks at Fenway Park, and we had the Texas Rangers mopping the Toronto Blue Jays at Rogers Center. AL East looking very interesting right now. Rays sweeping the Diamondbacks, Yankees tumbling down the standings, and the Orioles are also there too. But we will begin at the center of the baseball universe, which is Red Sox, Yankees, four games set. The finale of which was on Sunday Night Baseball with Will Middlebrooks and Roger Clemens in the booth next to pal of ours, Jason Benetti. This final game was a wild one with Sonny Gray going no-no into the eighth inning, losing the no-no, Aroldis Chapman losing the shutout, game tied, extra innings, back and forth affair with the Red Sox. Taking the dub on a Jaron Duran single to a two-man outfield to cap off the mop for the Boston Red Sox. And most importantly, Jordan, Jason Benetti using the mop on the broadcast?
He sure did. He sure did. They kept showing Wally, of course, the Red Sox mascot, running around with a broom after they finished the mop. And I think they showed it just enough, certainly to get my attention and maybe text Jason and be like, come on, it's a mop. Where's the mop for Wally? This is exactly when we came up with this. We said, people are bringing brooms to games. There's nothing stopping people from bringing mops to games. It's the same idea, right? It's not more dangerous. In fact, it's probably less dangerous to bring a mop to a game. It's a softer element than a broom. And yes, Jason did make a brief little mop reference as they went to commercial. But most importantly, the Boston Red Sox are alive. The fact that they were able to finish this off after, again, I mean, we could read the last few innings of last night's game were so chaotic and just one of those both teams deserve to lose games, truly. But the Red Sox managed to find a way at the end there. The Yankees kind of ran out of relievers, with all due respect to Fernando Cruz, who certainly had his moments. But extra innings can give you some weird stuff with the extra runner or with the automatic runner. And that's certainly what happened there in the bottom half. And I think for Boston, we can talk about, I mean, listen, they're still 10 games under 500. But to have a moments, four straight days at home, we've talked about how they've been historically awful at home this season, a place where they have been so comfortable for decades and decades and decades. They have been one of the worst. It's been one of the worst home records in the history of their franchise. And to have a weekend like this, regardless of whether it spurs a surge up the standings, I think you got to feel at least a little bit good for the Red Sox fans that have been suffering for all of these home games this year.
And again, for it to happen against the Yankees makes it all even sweeter. The vibrations in Boston are better. They have been so abysmal all season long. Chad Tracy, the manager that took over for Alex Cora, inherited those bad vibes and has been unable to kind of remedy the situation. We finally got some goofy, joking Chad Tracy after the sweep, making fun of our fellow reporter friends for having to control A, delete their articles. Delete, 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 as he said. Very relatable after the wonky game last night. Jordan, does this result meaningfully change the way that you think about the 2026 Boston Red Sox? As you mentioned, they are still 10 games over 500. They are now 4.5 games out of a wild card spot. Sorry, 10 games under 500. Very important difference. Important difference. They're 4.5 games out of a wild card spot in the messy, unsatisfactory American League. Like, is this a spark? Is this a catalyst? Or is this a blip?
Well, we'll zoom a little bit farther out and think about how we're feeling about the American League East standings and the American League standings. That 4.5 number sure doesn't look very big in terms of the wild card spot. Now, there are 5 teams ahead of them still, even before you get to that third wild card spot. So a lot of competition to jump. I think what was so encouraging about this series is how it happened, right? I mean, we've been talking a lot about Connelly Early and Peyton Tolley, and both of those guys were terrific. Connelly Early outdueling Cam Schlittler. Peyton Tolley, I think, had a perfect game through 5 or 6 innings on Friday. He was tremendous. And then Jake Bennett, another guy who we've seen a little bit of in the big leagues, and I don't know if he's necessarily guaranteed going to be in the rotation for the rest of the season, but he was better than Gerrit Cole on Saturday. They got another big swing from Wilson Contreras. Caleb Durbin continues to actually hit. I mean, he's been swinging it really well for a few weeks after being, frankly, Caleb the worst Durbin hitter in baseball for the first 2 months.
Caleb Durbin has been the best player on the Boston Red Sox in the month of June. That is a fact.
Yeah.
He has a 153 WRC plus, which is the highest in the team. He's still playing good defense over third. Just an out of nowhere offensive renaissance for a guy that looked pretty done and dusted a month ago. I think the reason that I am optimistic, cautiously optimistic about the Red Sox, right, is that if you said, hey, you're going to be without Gerrit Crochet and Roman Anthony, your best pitcher and your best hitter for most of the first half, and you'll be around 4 games out of a wild card spot when they get back, like, do they take that? Maybe not, but it certainly puts them within striking distance. Now, it also puts a lot of pressure on Gerrit Crochet, who could certainly handle that pressure, as we've seen last year during the playoffs. He loves it. It also puts a lot of pressure on Roman Anthony. And that was the storyline heading into the season is, wow, the Red Sox are really relying on this guy who is barely old enough to buy an alcoholic beverage to be their offensive cornerstone. Can he carry that, you know, backpack of rocks when he gets off the IL, whenever that may be? He was doing some throws in the outfield. I think we're still a couple weeks away. Today, I don't want to be duped by this team. They have duped us all before. They duped us leading into the season. Do I think they finish in a wild card spot? No. I do think that they will produce more false hope between now and the end of the season. Like, they're not done.
I think that that's fair. But about Anthony and Crochet, if there was another negative part of the weekend, it was that there was, once again, no update. That Crochet's still not throwing, Anthony's still not swinging a bat. And so, to your point, credit to them for kind of treading water here. I mean,
Try swinging a bat and Anthony could try throwing?
What would be more dangerous for their respective injuries? Probably Crochet swinging a bat, I think.
Anthony should never pick up a bat.
Trying to pitch, Anthony getting off a mound. Yeah, that's a good question. Now, I was about to say, credit to the Red Sox for treading water. The Red Sox are in the shallow end of the pool, also known as the American League. Their feet are touching the bottom, is maybe a good way to put it. So I'm not giving them credit.
Are you swimming
for this? Are you even swimming? Or are you just standing in the kiddie pool?
Are you just tall?
Which the American League is. So that's why I said, I was like, oh, they're training. Well, it's like, not really. They haven't actually played well at all until these past 4 days. But here they are this close. And I think that is what is so funny about this weekend. And sure, we get some time. Oh, my God, are the Yankees in a bad place? June swoon. They always suck in June. Here they go again. Sure, we could do that. And if they lose their next 10 games or, I mean, again, I know it's about to be July, so we'll see how they go into the break. But I think it is really funny as we take this conversation a little bit farther back and think about the American League East and what happened with the Rays and the Blue Jays. It is so appropriate. The true microcosm of the American League in 2026 is the only thing we thought we know is that the Yankees are way better than everybody else. And a nope. team that we've been laughing at the entire season mops them. And now here we are again. So I think my big takeaway as we look at these standings, and we can talk about the Rays and Blue Jays here, is one of these teams that we've been laughing at that have embarrassed themselves over and over, whether it is Boston, whether it is Detroit, Kansas City probably
Houston.
Not. Houston for sure. Toronto for sure. Baltimore maybe. The A's are just kind of floating in the middle. The Mariners are playing awful, awful, awful baseball, right? Cleveland's had their issues. One of the maybe multiple of those teams is going to make a run, be relevant. We are going to talk about them in September, and we just have to accept that. They can't all make it, but and I don't know which one it's going to be, but we do have to accept that that is what this American League is going to give us, that at least one of these teams that we have declared toast is not that. And whichever one actually ends up taking advantage of that, we're going to find out. Maybe it is Boston. Maybe it's one of these other teams that, you know, maybe it's Toronto, who right now we're feeling terrible about in the other direction. But I think that is the opportunity that is there for one of these teams, and we'll see which one of them actually takes it. And how that impacts the deadline is also very interesting.
Let's move to the Rays, mm-hmm. who swept this weekend at home against the Arizona Diamondbacks. They have now won 5 in a row, 7 of their last 10. Junior Caminero has 6 home runs over his last 5 games. He has been on absolute fire. Cedric Mullins has really picked things up. In the month of June, Jonathan Aranda and Yandy Diaz have just kept on keeping on. And the Rays, a team that like I was skeptical of because of how they were doing it, I think are doing it somewhat differently over this last little period of time. And a big part of that is the power production that they're getting from Junior Caminero, who is, no doubt, no question, braces and all, one of the best players in the sport. There is a legitimate argument that Junior Caminero is the best third baseman in the world right now, and his OPS is up to 932.
Let's pause on Caminero, okay? Because while he is still at negative 11 OAA, which is not awesome at the old hot corner.
Not a great defender. Not a great cold court.
And last year, it was weird because it started off that way, and then he clearly rallied and got his numbers back to like respectably bad as opposed to horrific. And now we have somehow reverted to, again, first percentile at the above average. Okay, I got the bad news out of the way. Here's the good news. This dude has taken, after hitting 45 home runs last season with the 130 OPS plus, has gotten way better offensively, which is an absurd thing to say, but that's what happens when you're 21 and you hit 45 homers. He has cut his strikeout rate while doubling his walk rate and continuing to hit the ball about as hard as you could possibly hope. That's what has his OBP above 380. He's hitting 290. He's still slugging as well as anybody. He's up to 22 homers, as you mentioned. And, I mean, we're just watching. And you still might be right. As awful as he's been defensively, I think, yeah, you can still say he's the best third baseman in the sport. And, frankly, the way I'm thinking about it is, where's he in the MVP conversation at this point? Second? Third? I mean, he's in the top 5, I think, pretty comfortably, I would say. When you consider the season that the Rays have had and how much of the offense he's driving. Now, Yandy Diaz is also right there, and we got to give him credit because both of those guys are over a 150 WRC plus, which is incredibly impressive. But Caminero is the bat that you are terrified of. Yandy Diaz is really, really, really good. Jonathan Aranda also really good. Junior Caminero is a game wrecker. And that is what we saw over the weekend. Yeah. That is what we saw, of course, last season. And yeah, he's not quite up at Yordan level right now. And Dylan Dingler, oh my goodness, has he been incredible. Bobby Witt, of course, although I don't even know how to talk about Bobby Witt right now, to be honest, because of how bad the Royals are and the fact that he's not even really hitting that much. But man, Caminero, that's
this is going to be
like,
one of
is,
the...
He's in the mix. Yeah, he's going to be in the mix for this, for the MVP.
If the Rays win the division, I know it's not a team award, but it is in people's brains. If the Rays win the division and he's like leading in a lot of offensive categories, you could definitely see him finishing in the top three. This is going to be one of the weirdest MVP races we've ever had.
Oh, yeah.
At least as long as we've been covering the sport, because like, should it be Bobby Witt? Will it be Bobby Witt? I would say yes. Like, would you take Bobby or the field? I would take Bobby. But because the Royals are such a catastrophe and have shown no signs of improving, and because Bobby Witt's offensive numbers are not as overwhelming as you'd expect, like his value is built on defense and base running, it will be a question there. I just think that when push comes to shove, people are like, well, it's Bobby Witt Jr. And this is just something, I know we're going off track here. This might be like one of the best chances Bobby Witt Jr. has to win an MVP, like in a Judge is hurt year. And so like he should take the reins and like go do the damn thing, because there is a window there that won't always be there.
Yeah. Bobby Witt is going to be a very interesting character for the rest of the season because of basically exclusively this. I think he's capable of heating up offensively to the point where it is very obvious that he should win. But right now, you think about the story of the season, we're halfway through, and Bobby Witt has this huge lead on Caminero and everybody else because he is this unbelievable shortstop defender. It really is that simple. His WRC plus is 124. That's really good for one of the best shortstop defenders we've seen in a long time. But does it feel like Bobby Witt Jr. has dominated the season? Like, no, it doesn't. I mean, he's amazing. I'm not saying he definitively does not deserve it. But right now, I would be way more inclined to vote for Yordan, to vote for Junior Caminero, to vote for Dylan Dingler. There's still a lot of time left. And I would also just push back on what you said is best chance. I mean, Bobby Witt's, what, 25, 26? He's going to have other chances to win this. But it is still true that this is a big opportunity with Judge out of the mix. So I agree with you, though. Part of the American League is weird conversation is that the American League MVP is going to be weird as well. And I think that's a really good point.
Aaron Judge, who has not played a baseball game in, since that 4-day-old Red Sox fan was born and then some, is 20th in Fangraph's war among American League position players still, because he is Aaron Judge. Let's finish up this conversation with the Blue Jays. The Toronto Blue Jays, who should be thanking the Canadian men's soccer team for taking some heat off of their shoulders, the fight in Maple Leafs with a rousing 1-0 victory on Sunday over South Africa in the famous Canadian city of Los Angeles, where they played. Mm-hmm. Hilarious. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, and this was literally happening, like that game was going on as the Jays were blowing game four of their series against the Rangers in embarrassing fashion. Like as Jared Kelnick is scurrying home from second base to home on a pass ball, two bases. Canada's going wild across the country, two countries. So that was convenient for them. Blue Jays are in a bad place right now. Not only are they playing bad baseball, but the whole thing just looks lethargic. And it starts and it begins and it ends with Vlad Jr., whose OPS starts with a 6.
Ooh.
Yes. Gentlemen,
ooh, not a 7.
That dominated
a six.
Oof. The gentleman that dominated our baseball lives last October has cobbled together a season that is utterly woeful. He has 4 home runs. He's hitting 268, 34 RBI, 679 OPS. You can double check this, Jordan. Does he have a home run? Has he gone yard?
Still no.
At Robinson?
I was just checking that. It's exactly what I was checking.
Vlad, no homers. And this we had a moment of potential tension where I think it was in game two or game three of this set against the Rangers. Alejandro Kirk hits a homer late, kind of a garbage time homer. I think it moves the score from 7-3 to 7-4. And the Blue Jays, for many years now, have had their home run jacket, the bedazzled coat with all the countries on it that got a lot of pub last year during their playoff run. And as Vlad is on the top step about to put it on Kirk, Kirk kind of just blows him off. Doesn't put it on, scurries into the dugout. And there's a look on Vlad's face of like, huh, that was weird. Now, Hazel May, who is the Jays sideline reporter for Sportsnet, kind of sent out a tweet downplaying this a little bit, saying that, oh, the sleeve was inside out. Sure. And I believe that someone told that to her. I don't know, man. I don't know. I have heard, just to be clear, like from people around baseball, like coaches especially, that don't like the home run celebration as a thing. Because if you're losing and you do it, you look like an idiot. And if you're losing and you don't do it, you look like an idiot. It creates this lose-lose scenario when you're losing. Like the Mets, you know, putting on the Spider-Man mask and high-fiving one another after a homer and then having their manager fired the next day is just like a very wonky, unnecessary look. And so I have heard that like there are people around the game that are like, have we gone a little too far? It should be an established thing. You only break this out when you're winning. Like there's a way to do it that works. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but like, let's talk about this particular one. Because I think the Jays home run jacket is one of the more public, well-known home run celebrations we have. And this is not like two newbies having a mix up over this. I'm sure that Alejandro Kirk has hit meaningless home runs before and that Vlad has put the jacket on it. What did you make of this one?
No, that last point is spot on. And I've had this thought about the celebrations as well. I do feel like I'm surprised how committed to the bit most teams are, regardless of circumstance. And you could argue that their perspective is, hey, you know what? We should have a home run in the major leagues. That should be celebrated. I don't know. Who cares what the score? It's a long season. Support our teammates. And honestly, I think that there's some truth to that. But from the fan perspective and from the coach's perspective, it does set up the opportunity. I'm surprised that there is not more of a, like, let's go to it when it feels like it. I have been surprised by that in general. Sure. That applies to all home runs, all home run celebrations. In this case, I don't want to read too much into it. It's just one of those things that, man, when it's going bad, you get to have stuff like this replayed over and over and over. Like this is, you can apply this to so many things throughout the season with teams that are struggling, because this exact thing happening, if the Jays had won 10 in a row, would just be like a weird, funny thing. And instead it's like, oh no, is there a disconnect? But to your point, that last point, Kirk and Vlad, these are two of the guys that have been there the longest that I'm sure have a good relationship. So I don't blame Kirk for just being like, all right, I homered, whatever. We're still in a funk. Let's just move forward. I don't think that means he's mad at Vlad. And I also don't blame Vlad for still trying to, because the other version you say of it is probably teams trying to be like, well, this is something that can like make us feel good. Like, let's try and get something going here, regardless of how it looks. And I wouldn't be surprised if Vlad is kind of thinking about it that way.
But yeah, this is not Sean Keyes trying to put a coat on Luis Arias, you know, like these are not noobs here. Yeah. Luis Arias is on the Blue Jays right now.
Luis Arias is on the Blue Jays.
Luis Arias.
Okay. Well,
is on the Blue Jays.
I was going to say, who he well aware for? About Sean Keyes. I'm fired. I almost took Sean Keyes in the 2024 redraft. I love Sean Keyes. Luis Arias, that is complete news to me that he was on this team. One more thing about the Vlad, and then we should give the Rangers some credit.
I have another Vlad.
Do you know when his do you know when his last home run was? I don't know if that's what you were going to bring.
I'm going to guess it was in May.
Wait, what? No, you just told you it didn't happen. Last home homer for Vlad Jr.
Oh, last home homer. I'm sorry. I thought you said homer.
Oh.
Last home homer would have been in the playoffs, no?
Yes, correct. But it wasn't in the World Series. He came damn close in Game 7, as we all thought. But his two homers in the World Series were both in L.A., which means that the last home homer was Game 6 of the CS, which I was in the building for. That was October 19th against Logan Gilbert. Is the last time Vlad Jr. homered at home. The last time he homered in general, now you have me wondering about that, was, oh, it was in Boston a few weeks ago. But that's, he only has one homer in the last, yeah, almost a month and a half. He's basically got, he had one homer in May, one homer in June, and two homers in April. So, yeah, man, I mean, it ain't great. It ain't great. Vlad Jr., you're the guy.
Might start the All-Star game, though.
If, do you think,
so we got all the All-Star finalists, right? Which we don't really need to get into right now. The first base race is Guerrero and Ben Rice. I hope Ben Rice gets it, even though he's been a lot worse.
He's been
Vladdy. Vladdy, if he gets into the All-Star game, will decline it. I feel pretty strongly about that.
Probably right about that. Yeah.
The last Blue Jays thing is, do you know who the Blue Jays have coming to town this week?
Yes. Well, I set it up. Go ahead.
The New York Mets. So this is great because it is two teams wearing it and someone has to take it off this week. Like, someone has to win the series. One of these two teams will finish the series feeling good about themselves, which is impossible to think will happen, but is factually true. Mostly it is important because one, Mr. Bo Bichette will be returning to Toronto, a place that he set asunder, that he sent into ecstasy last October with a swing that should have made him a legend forever. And in some ways it did, in some ways it did not. He will be cheered. There's no chance he'll be booed. It will be very cool. And maybe this is the moment that, you know, puts everybody back into good vibes. Or, you know, he shows back up there. He's like, I like it here. And he demands a trade. He demands a trade to the Blue Jays at the deadline. And Bo's been better recently. Like, he's not killing it, but he has been better.
Yeah, he has been better. And if he homers in this series and people say, wow, Bo's got a home run in Toronto more recently than Vlad does. That's already funny. True, I guess, because of what happened in the World Series. But it would be even more poignant if he does homer this week.
Yeah.
Here's my prediction. I think they both homer this week. How about that?
Oh.
I think that this is maybe the same game. We go like alternating innings. We get Bo and Vlad, and Blue Jays fans are, and they're still celebrating Team Canada. It'll be a great week at Rogers Center.
Bo homers and runs to the wrong dugout because of muscle memory. There you go. Open up your third eye. All right.
Does he get the jacket? Does he get the jacket?
He puts the jacket on. Yeah, all the whole nine yards. Kudos to the Rangers, who won four in a row.
Yeah.
We probably should spend more time talking about. I mean, they're in first place.
First place.
Back at the 500. That's great. Happy for them. That division sucks so hard.
Sure does.
You want to back pocket the Rangers? Maybe talk about them on Wednesday. Orioles, briefly, who lost 2-3 to the Nats over the weekend. Good series for the Nats after that catastrophe against the Phillies at home to just get like, hey, our bullpen does suck. They tried to blow a couple more games with the bullpen, but we're good. Like, the Nats are, this was not the start of a capitulation. This was just a blip. Will it all fall apart at some point this season? Maybe, maybe not. They got back to winning ways. The Orioles are in a weird place. Adley is on the IL. Mike Elias, their president of baseball operations, spoke, and I would say the most interesting thing from that was just he wants to go for it. He had a quote, we're going for it. I'll let you know if that changes. And that is a product of the American League being so non-competitive. I will be up at Camden Yards this week for Orioles White Sox, which I am very interested in.
Yeah, I think the other part of that Mike Elias quote was him saying, like, we're right there. And when I read that, I was like, are you? And I was like, oh, yeah, three games back. What am I? Who am I to tell him he's wrong, right? So I don't, as I mentioned earlier, how this actually influences trade deadline activity, there is still a long way to go. Trade deadline, we should mention, 5 weeks from today. So that is both a lot of time and not a lot of time. But we are officially on the clock here. And how teams, I mean, I guess for both of these teams, but certainly in the context of the American League, Baltimore will be one to watch. And I think I will say that Baltimore is really important because they got stuff to move. if they decide to sell, Taylor Ward is going to be desired, right? If they're willing to trade Ryan Helsley, some of their other relievers, maybe even some of their starters, there are players teams will want. Trevor Rogers. There are players that teams will want. And that is not true. There are some other American League teams where it's like, well, what do they even have to sell? They might as well just try and win. In this case, that would be a big decision. They could, you know, take advantage of being a seller in that case. Now, is that going to make Orioles fans feel good? No. But it is something that I'm sure cold calculating Mike Elias is certainly considering, even if right now he is saying that he is going for it. Last thing on the Nationals, I'll just mention they are going to Boston. So that is another series I'm interested to watch this week to see if, you know, the Nats can.
Do they play a Paul Taboni tribute video?
Wow, great question.
Paul Taboni tribute
no
video?
No chance.
Obviously not. But that would be so funny if it was just like footage of him like in meetings and wearing a polo shirt, like walking around.
It's like him sitting.
It's like him like sitting at a minor league game.
Like the Big 12 tournament or something. Like he's like doing.
And then it like, I know he's it like cuts to scouting, the Fenway Park crowd like cheering. And then it like it cuts back to him like writing down on notes. Paul Bodoni? Who?
Yeah. So I assume Paul will be on that trip, but maybe I'm wrong. All right. We're going to take a break. Before we do that, oh, by the way, special guest Sam Blum making his baseball Barbacast debut. How excited are we about that? But before we get to Sam talking about the actual biggest news of the weekend, which is that the Angels fired Perry Minasian, let us remind you that the Yahoo Sports MLB YouTube channel launches next Friday, July 10th. Oh, keep an eye out for where to subscribe to that channel. You will see all of our stuff on that brand fresh new YouTube channel. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, the great Sam Blum of The Athletic. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We now welcome in a very special guest. It is Sam Blum of The Athletic making his Barbacast debut. Sam, welcome to the show.
Just what an honor. I mean, we've been waiting for this day, so happy to be on.
Millions of listeners presumably have too. Now, Sam, you are here not just because you are a charismatic young man who writes more articles than make me think, why didn't I think of that? Really than anybody else in the business. You are here because you said something aloud to my good friend Jordan Schusterman here at the Draft Combine a couple of days ago, and I will let Jordan tell the story.
Yeah, so Sam and I were hanging out in the desert trying to stay cool last week, I should say. And Sam, understandably, a friend of the show for quite some time, and has seen some of his colleagues come on the podcast. And he said, hey, man, like, when am I coming on? This is not the only person to ask in that manner, but Sam is one of my favorites. And I said, man, you're right. Like, we should have Sam. What are we waiting for? And I said, you know what? The Angels, that you've chronicled their misfortunes and missteps as well as anybody over the years. If and when they give us a news peg this season, in all likelihood, Perry Minasian getting fired, that could be a time for you to come on the podcast and talk about the Angels. And sure enough, 2 days later, that is exactly what happened. So now here you are on Monday to talk about the big news of the weekend, which is that Perry Minasian is no longer in charge of the Angels front office. My question to you, Sam, to start this off is, when I said that, oh, you can come on if Perry gets fired, did you know, oh, nice, I'm about to be on in the next week? And if not, how surprised were you by the news on Friday? And why now? Why is what happened that led to this decision from Molly Jolly and Artie Moreno and the Angels higher-ups that Perry Minasian is no longer in charge?
Well, I didn't know it was coming, but I will say the second I saw that it had happened, I didn't tweet it, I didn't do anything, I texted you. So I said, when am I coming on? Which didn't get a reply for a day, by the way. why now? I mean, this has been in the works for weeks. At least that's kind of what's been portrayed. And I think it's interesting because if you go back a few weeks, that was the low point of the season. I mean, they've actually played above 500 baseball now for more than a month. So it is interesting, the timing of it, because generally in Angels world, when things can be portrayed as going well, like that is enough for, you know, everyone to feel safe and feel secure in their job. So if anything, I think it's a smart step. I mean, and ultimately, just because things were a little bit better for the Angels doesn't mean this wasn't the right move. I think when you look at the big picture under Perry Minasian, it wasn't just the wins and losses, which were ultimately 392 and 500, but it was also, I think, just the overall culture of the place. It wasn't, you know, Perry, I think, kind of had taken a lot of authority on even things like the draft and, you know, just smaller areas that maybe should be left to, you know, player development people or, you know, draft people or whatever it was. So, yeah, it just it felt like it was going in this direction that it was going to be in perpetuity, the same results year after year after year, if not, you know, slight fluctuations in either bad to really bad. So I don't know if this fixes anything, but that's the Angels for you. That's what I've been covering for about 6 years now, and we'll see if it gets any different. I'll hold my breath. But,
What in your mind is Perry's legacy? I think the way that we think about him within the context of this organization, you have to take Artie Moreno, the owner, into account. He is arguably the single worst owner, the least successful, least productive owner that we have in our sport. And I think that his refusal to adopt change has been a major reason why the Angels have the single longest playoff drought in the sport. And yep. Perry was hamstrung by that reality. But within that context, how would you evaluate his performance?
Yeah, I mean, the only team with a longer playoff drought is the New York Jets. So that's not a conversation you want to, I know this is a baseball audience, but you don't want to be in that mix.
No, you don't.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, listen, I mean, I think Artie is obviously the underlying element of every single thing that happens for the Angels. Like, it is, you know, you can't erase him from the record. You can't erase him from Perry's legacy. I think, you know, the biggest move or non-move or thing that happened over these last six seasons was the decision to retain Shohei Ohtani at the 2023 trade deadline, when, you know, they could have made, I think, franchise altering decisions that would have brought on players that right now, they, if they had them, may make them a competitive team in a very weak American League. And I think that's always kind of the fatal flaw of the Angels is not recognizing when there is, you know, an opportunity to actually build and create an organization that can win. So, yeah, I mean, what's the legacy? I think you could look at that one singular decision. I think you look at, you know, just everything as a whole. I mean, you know, I think every year they set records for number of players on their roster. It was just constant turnover, constant chaos. I mean, I wrote it in the article when he first got let go. It was just like, it's one thing after the other after the other. I mean, that's what it is for me. It's not one single moment or one single failure. It's like yelling about air conditioning. Like it's, you know, just like drafting 21 pitchers in a, you know, completely unnecessarily. Like it's just like, or it's waving six guys at the beginning of September. Just like,
yeah,
holy crap. It's like, you couldn't get a day off from it. And yet they were never any good. And they were not a team that anyone thought was ever competitive.
It was, to me, there's like an element of Wilpon era Mets to it, where it's like, they're not just losing, they're coming up with preposterous headlines at the same time again and again and again. I had a buddy of mine from high school ask me recently, like, how do you in your job critique people that you then need to see again all the time? And something that I said was like, you have to criticize decisions. You say, oh, this was a bad decision, not this is a bad decision maker. But the Angels clearly, and I said this, is like over time you compile enough bad decisions and we need to evaluate you for the totality of those decisions. And I think the Angels, due to the sheer bizarreness of Perry Minasian era choices, I think you're right that Perry's legacy can be evaluated separate from Artie's.
Yeah. And, you know, even to that point, like, yeah, that was a question I had for myself. Cause I don't think Perry would pick up my phone call today. You know what I mean? Like, it's just the reality of the situation, but I mean, and it's sure. Not like that was always the case. Perry was like, I would say at times quite helpful, or at least attempted to be quite helpful with me and, you know, nice and you know, approachable and things like that. But I like think what like what you say is like when you're covering it for 6 years, at some point, you know, you're just kind of seeing the same failures over and over again, kind of the same issues over and over again. And it's like, okay, like, are you willing to sacrifice the relationship to just kind of like be really honest about what this is? And I think that was kind of where I was at. And, you know, his, you know, it's like, what can you do? I mean, this is like, if you're going to cover the Angels, like, you're going to have to be willing to annoy people. And there are other people in his front office who are more helpful at times. And, you know, you start to learn a little bit more about just the inner workings of the organization when I think those people feel like, okay, like we're the way we feel about the situation is being written about at least by someone. Yeah, I mean, I think we'll see what happens under
like, it doesn't give you joy. Obviously, yeah. Right? Like, I think that is something that is worth conveying. Like, you're not waking up every day being like, wow, I hope the Angels do something stupid again. Like, no.
Yeah, it's like, okay, like,
you would obviously prefer the opposite.
Yeah, like, you know, I think if anyone remembers, like, that interaction when they hired Kurt Suzuki, and, like, I'm asking Perry about what Yusei Kikuchi said, you know, that they didn't have air conditioning in their gym at the end of last season, like, that's just an easy question to answer that he just turns into this weird battle, like, of like going back and forth. And, you know, he's like, well, is Kikuchi happy here? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I guess, like, that's not the question though. He made things a weird battle at times. And you don't want to you can't evaluate him on that. But I think overall, like, it speaks to just like the desperation and the, you know, uneasiness he even had in that job working for Artie, trying not to ever say anything wrong. And that's what stood out to me about the Mozeliak press conference on Saturday. I mean, anybody can win an intro press conference, but it felt like he wasn't really terrified of the owner. Like, it just felt like he was, okay, like, you know, I don't need this. I'm here. We'll see if I do a good job, great. If they tell me I can't do a good job, then I'm just going to leave in a few months and my life will continue on as it had. So he's got like a little bit more of like a little more authority in this role. And I think it's important to have somebody who can kind of like have some credibility because, you know, Perry was hired over more qualified candidates when he was hired at the end of the 2020 calendar year. And I think part of that is because, you know, already wants somebody he can kind of just boss around and who will say, yes, sir. And that's kind of it. And now he doesn't have that. So maybe it'll be better.
I think before I do want to spin it back and start to look forward about Mozeliak, about Molly Jolly, who I truly do believe we need to like describe and explain as a character in this decision. I mean, the point that I've always made about the Angels and why whenever anyone's like, oh, they're piling on, they are the last team. And this is what happens when you lose this much. And they're not the only team that's like this. They're the last team that deserves the benefit of the doubt. And so, no matter what the decision is, even when some stuff would occasionally work. Oh, look, we're rushing these guys to the big leagues, and some of them Walbert, it's actually working. Walbert Urania, yeah. Soriano, like they have these little flashes where you're like, hey, maybe they are actually kind of good at this very specific kind of evaluation that they're you know, doing a little bit differently, and it's maybe working. The problem is when you keep losing in different ways, sometimes 100 games, sometimes 90 games, sometimes whatever, there's no reason to believe that you are suddenly doing something that's better than everybody else. And so when you add in all the other missteps that were blatantly egregious that you've chronicled over the years, you just kind of throw your hands up and say, well, sorry, until you start winning baseball games, why am I going to give you the benefit of the doubt? And ultimately, in Perry's case, this is another good way to flip it back to Mozeliak. I mean, and think about the almost the delusional perception of what was going on. That was true also with people on the ground in terms of the coaching staff and Suzuki. I think back to when Perry was introduced and he was like, this is an opportunity. Like, this is not a rebuild. We have a chance to be a great team already. I'm not coming in here. And that was after they'd already lost however many games they hadn't made the playoffs in years and years and years. And now you see it's only gotten worse. So before we spin it to Mozeliak again, just to kind of wrap that up, is there anything else there in terms of how you've evaluated where it's just like, listen, sure, you've hit on some things, but it's just on the whole, you're still in last place. You're still this bad team.
Well, that was what stood out to me was like it was, you're right. It was like this benefit of the doubt that was expected of a team that had been like so bad forever. I mean, even just like in May, the last time he talked, he became super inaccessible really over the last year and a half, I would say. But he was like, yeah, like, almost, of course, this is our best baseballs ahead of us. Like, it was as if you know, it was ridiculous to think otherwise. I'm like, how, what are Why? You talking about? This, what about this has earned you, you know, the belief that, you know, that all these fans should think this is getting better. I mean, and you know, I mean, I think part of this ties back to all the, you know, all the people in the stands chanting, sell the team. And, you know, sure. Just the general anger around the club. Like, I think, you know, is this a reaction to that? Maybe to some extent, just like hearing your fans and hopefully recognizing that they're upset, because for so long, I think they've been able to mask that a little bit. You know, you play in a really dense population area. They get good crowds, great weather. Like, people will come out for the game, like, just because it's big league baseball in Anaheim. And I think that's changing a little bit. And, you know, the grift is only going to last so long. Yes. And this, you know, this was kind of maybe the, okay, we need to address that a little bit.
So that's a great transition to this decision. And can you tell people who Molly Jolly is? When she got hired or promoted, we were like, oh my God, this person's named Molly Jolly. That's amazing. She's been at the Angels for,
not only,
I think, not a while.
Only is her name Molly
opted
Jolly.
Into Molly Jolly.
She opted into Molly Jolly. Yeah. She changed her name. Her husband was Mr. Jolly. She could have been Molly something or other. She looked around. She said, I would like Jolly, please. So that's, I think, important context here.
That in and of itself, we're like all in. But tell us who she is, what her role has been, what her role is in this decision, because it seems like she's as at the top. I mean, you still haven't heard from Artie Moreno yet, if I'm mistaken. The press conference was with ever, right? Yeah. So Molly Jolly and John Mozeliak were... They were the ones doing the presser after a chaotic sequence on Friday that led to this announcement. So who is she, and how do you sense that she came upon John Mozeliak if it wasn't already? Like, how did they land on Johnny Mo?
Well, not only did she opt into the name, but they also made this announcement during the Angels' Christmas in June. So it was a very Molly Jolly Christmas.
That's a good...
Anyway.
That's so true.
She's, you know, Molly Jolly's been there forever, right? Like, she's, you know, I don't get many Angels fans, and certainly baseball fans don't really know who she is, but she's been an important person, I think, in the Angels universe for a while. And, as you know, you when people talk about her, they talk about her really highly. And I don't know if that's, you know, sometimes I think I'm getting sold a little bit on just the next thing with the Angels, because, you know, you talk about the John Carpino era who retired, you know, back in March, and you talk about all these things that have failed. And I think, you know, the Angels are always trying to sell you on, okay, well, the next thing's going to be better. And Molly Jolly is maybe right now the next thing. But I will say, if this played out as they say it did, which was Molly deciding they need to move on from Perry, Molly deciding that they needed to hire Mozeliak, Molly kind of doing everything as it has landed them into this position. And then I will give her a ton of credit, because I think that is 100% what needed to happen. And, you know, you got to give her the benefit of the doubt. She's been in this job now for a couple months, and I think in those couple months, they've essentially done the right thing here. They've put themselves on a path forward where, if they follow it to the way that they say they will, might ultimately be successful. Now, there's still so many questions about what that looks like. But yeah, Molly's been, you know, I mean, she's basically, I think, you know, assisted essentially in the business operations. I got to know her a little bit more over the last half year, because she spent 3 months at the Skaggs trial. She was at the defense table for the entire thing. She testified. And I thought that was interesting even at the time, because, you know, it became the person who was going to represent them in that matter was either going to be John Carpino or Molly Jolly. And they picked Molly. And then a few months later, Molly takes over as president of the team. So, you know, maybe there's a connection there. I think clearly Artie values her opinion and values kind of her stewardship of the franchise to some extent. But when it comes to Mozeliak and the context that she fits into this, like, we'll see, because, you know, he said he didn't even communicate with Artie, like, not even a phone call before this happened, which I find almost impossible to believe. I don't know how you can take this particular job without talking to that guy. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And if he did, I would wonder why, right? Like, why would you want to take on this role without knowing with a vision for what you're going to be authorized to do? Like, this is not a smart decision to make if you don't know that. If you don't know you can make trades to the trade deadline, that you don't know you can.
Yeah.
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 So yes, but the thing with Mozeliak that is important and interesting to understand, and then we'll wrap this up, is that he's playing with house money in regards to his own legacy.
Yeah, Sam said
Johnny
it
Moe.
You nailed it before.
Does not need this, right? Like, he's playing with house money. And so it's like, it's weird that he did not call Artie. But if he steps into the job and he feels like Artie's restricting him, he's just going to go back to his beach house. You know what I mean? And so it's like to me, there's very little downside from Mozeliak's perspective. I think in terms of evaluating Mozeliak as a hire, right? He is an interesting character here because on one hand, he's had all this success, right? But like, it's 2026, brother. And there's a reason that he's not working for the Cardinals anymore. So like, in your understanding around the industry, what is like the level of faith that Mozeliak was the right person for this job at this time?
I mean, I think it's just like a serious baseball person. Like, we're like, you're right. Like, obviously, it's and the end of his tenure in St. Louis was not ideal. And, you know, it just kind of maybe was a natural endpoint. But I mean, there's always the next step and, you know, the next thing can kind of lead to maybe a better fit. I agree with you ultimately, right, that he doesn't need this. So if it's going to go poorly and Artie's going to tell him he can't do this, that, and the other, then he will just leave at the end of his contract and, you know, life will continue on as normal for him. But actually, one of the things he said during his press conference, which really stood out to me, was he almost kind of criticized Artie and said that, you know, Artie is maybe too much of a fan. And what does that mean, right? Like, that means you maybe have a hard time trading away a Shohei Ohtani. You have a hard time trading away a Reed Detmers or, you know, Jose Soriano or Joe Adell, or just, you know, or even if he's not too much of a fan, that he thinks that these are the players that fans are coming to watch, that it's like it's just an inability to make a really tough choice and to put your team in a position for a long-term, you know, solution here. And I don't think the Angels would be years and years away from competing if they were to trade some of these guys. I think that they'd be, you know, if you really start to you know, embrace what it would take to rebuild the club through, you know, trades and young players and, you know, maybe a couple splashes in free agency, I think you're looking at 1 or 2 years, really. It's not insane. Like, teams do it all the time now. So the Angels just kind of have refused to sacrifice even half a season. They don't even want to tell their team, their fans, that, you know, these last 2 months of a season, we're already on pace to lose like 95 games in. We're going to punt. Like, that's just not the way they go about it. I don't agree with it, but it's just the Angels in a nutshell. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. I think he's going to have a chance to do what he wants to do. And if not, he'll go ahead and leave.
It's also kind of why, as chaotic as this is, it's kind of perfect timing and the perfect person, because he has so little attachment to any of this. If Jolly, and I guess Artie by extension, allows him to do what he wants to do, presumably that means trading a bunch of guys at the deadline. If that doesn't happen and they end up buying for some reason, I mean, I don't know how that's going to work, then we see, okay, well, then this is essentially hopeless, because clearly the whole point here is to have John Mozeliak come in and say, this is all the things that are wrong. We are going to slowly try and fix this. Now, you could still say, oh, well, they should have done this past offseason. You could say they should have done it a million times in the past however many years to give them more of a chance to build this back up, and how they're going to handle the draft, which is now less than 2 weeks away. That's a big question. But I do agree with you that there is an opportunity here to at least start to identify these things. And that was the thing that Mozeliak said on his, when he went on the broadcast, he was like, patience, patience, patience. And that is the opposite of what Perry said. Perry's saying, we got a winner here. Here we go. Let's go. Let's go. They were saying it this season. Not patience of, oh, our best baseball is ahead of us. Patience of, this takes time to identify what is wrong and to fix it. And at this point, with the fans chanting sell the team, it's hard to imagine that most fans with a reasonable perspective on this are going to be like, oh, no. Oh, God, we're trading. Like, yeah, of course, if you like Joe Adell. And, yeah, there's a hurt in that. But that's something that at this point is so obviously necessary. And to your point, an opportunity to move in the right direction. And that is why I am encouraged about, just frankly, as you mentioned, you don't want to get too bought into them winning the press conference and saying the right things, but they've been saying the wrong things so many times over the years that even hearing the right things and hearing like there's a plan in place, hearing that, as you mentioned, there's just at least a competent vision and acknowledgement that where they are is unacceptable and embarrassing. I just think you have to feel now how dramatic that looks. I mean, that is where the Angels now do become way more interesting at the deadline than they were before. Because if Perry was still there, I would expect them to just float in the middle and acquire some relievers for some reason and then just do nothing. And instead, now I think they might trade Reed Detmers. Now I think they might trade Soriano, whatever, Adell. Like, that, I think that's all now possible, but I also still won't believe it until I see it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think to your point, like, I don't think Angels fans have any attachment to a single player on this team than Mike Trout. I mean, all, you know, I mean, they like guys more than other guys, but, like, I don't think anybody here is moving the needle long-term, you know, the way we talk about even former Angels that didn't win the World Series, you know, that are still popular. You know, there's just nobody here that I think kind of fits that mold necessarily. So we'll see. I mean, I think we'll find out even at the draft in some ways, because the way that the Angels would always draft the same way, you know, you would get these underslot college players in the first round, really the first five rounds in a lot of the cases, and then would maybe go way over on a high school player in the middle to later part of the draft. And like, that was always how they did it. And I don't know if that was an already kind of, we don't want a high school player in the first round type of decision, or if it was more of a Perry, you know, this is how we're going to go about the draft. So I think we'll find out, you know, we'll find out some things, you know, within the next couple of weeks. And then especially when you get to the trade deadline, like, is it going to look like the last five? Then if it is, then maybe you've that's a bad sign. And then
the Angels draft a high school kid with their first pick. Parade.
So, yeah, I mean, they're picking 12 and 45. So, you know, they're not at the very top like they were last year. But, I would also say, like, the last thing is we're going to learn some stuff here soon, deadline, draft, whatever. There are much bigger questions that we aren't going to know. It sounds like the coaching staff is going to stay in place for better or for worse. Who the actual long-term president of baseball operations is going to be that Mozeliak is in charge of finding, that is a process that is underway, but we don't know what that's going to look like. So those are bigger questions that we could have you on again when those things get decided. There's a lot to fix here, obviously.
The funniest outcome is that Mozeliak trades Trout and then leaves. You know? Like, that's the
Trout. That's one thing I don't think is going to happen. But
he's gonna go to the Guardians or Jordan every day.
I've seen a lot of Guardians fans. They're like, "Oh, Trout, right?" I'm like, "Yeah." They would take on his contract, and their whole organization would go bankrupt as a result.
Sam, you are a man I would be willing to go bankrupt for. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Great being here.
You are a beautiful soul, and you are good at your job. And go Columbia Lions. That's all I got. We'll be right back on Baseball Podcast.
Roar. Glad we got that on. Josh Simpson back in the big.
Oh, Josh Simpson back in the bigs. All right. Columbia superfan, Sam Blum, thank you so much for joining us. And yeah, if you haven't read Sam's, all of his Angels coverage over the years has been incredibly valuable and insightful. So we encourage you to check out what Sam wrote about Perry getting let go. And Sam, you'll be back at some point. Maybe when Perry gets rehired.
Yes.
Hired as the manager. All right. Goodbye.
Thank you, Sam.
Bye.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to Sam Blum. Let's get to the rest of the action from the weekend, and let's go fast. It's turbo mode.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Cubs take 2 out of 3 over the Brewers, but the Brewers win the hearts and minds because Jacob Mizorowski threw a pitch 105.5 miles an hour.
Too fast? What do we think? Are we approaching too fast?
Okay. Too fast, too furious, too lanky, too much Mizorowski.
The Brewers do win that opener, but the Cubs bounce back. They get David Peterson throwing his longest outing since last August in his Cubs debut. That after allowing a home run on the first pitch to Jackson Chourio. David Peterson will save the Cubs, surely.
David Peterson, longest outing of the year. I think the Cubs actually sent someone to New York to kick David Stearns in the balls as this happened, just like to add insult to injury. Injury to insult.
It goes in both directions. And then on Sunday, the Cubs survive an extra inning rally. Jordan Wicks with the Houdini act of the season, escaping bases loaded, no outs in the bottom of the 10th, getting Gary Sanchez grounded to a double play. Cubs win 5-4.
And yeah, but that's not that hard. That's not that hard. Getting Gary Sanchez to ground into a double play, I feel like I've done that. You know what I mean? Like, it's
Yeah,
you're either giving up a tank or it's a double play.
Well, and Gary did homer earlier in that game, but did not come through there. The Cubs are up to second place in the NL Central. Credit to them, but they are still 5.5 behind Milwaukee. Let's keep it in the National League. You mentioned David Stearns. Was he paying attention to what David Peterson was doing for the Cubs? Probably not. He was probably more focused on his team series against the Philadelphia Phillies, where the Phillies took the first game of the Andy Green era, a narrow 2-1 victory on Friday, including a ridiculous Derek Hill home run robbery of Juan Soto. Mets bounce back on Saturday with a rousing victory, 4 runs in the sixth. And Andy Green says, now we go. Now we go, baby. I got Christian Scott on my side. Nothing can stop me except the Phillies the very next day. As Kyle Schwarber hits his 30th home run of the season, a go-ahead two-run shot in the top of the seventh after a feel-good A.J. Ewing game-tying homer. And the Phillies take this series and are in. They are climbing fast, these standings, I got to say.
Kyle Schwarber, we have become numb to this man and his greatness. It is remarkable. He is up to 30 home runs. That is like he's played in 80 games. I think the Phillies have played in 84. He missed a couple there. I mean, he is going to chase down 60. Last year, he made a run at the Phillies' all-time franchise record, which was Ryan Howard, and fell just short, if I remember correctly. I don't think that Kyle Schwarber is losing sleep at night, being like, man, I need to have the Phillies' single season home run record. That being said, I do believe that he will make a real run at it. What a remarkable player. Like, I adore everything about Kyle Schwarber. 30 home runs, and it is June 29th.
Yeah, and he will also probably set the strikeout record, and God bless him for it. I am intrigued by the Phillies home run totals. So Kyle Schwarber has 30. Bryce Harper has 19. Do you know who's third and fourth?
Well, Brandon Marsh has 11. I believe
12. He's got 12.
12.
But he
had another one.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And fourth then I would on the go in home. Fourth on the. You're asking me, Jake. Hey, Jake, who is fourth on the Phillies in home runs? That's the question.
You know the Phillies. You know the Phillies. Sorry for asking.
I'm gonna go with Bryson Stott.
Bryson Stott is tied with Trey Turner and Adolis Garcia with 7. But that is fewer than Alec Boehm with 9. Oh, Alec Boehm, who says
enough.
This guy enough. Stinks at hitting.
Well, but here's quickly on the Phillies. So much of them figuring this out. Like, you look at Alec Boehm and Bryson Stott's season numbers and like you're like, okay, whatever. Yeah. Like, they have been actually good players since May 1. And sure. That is the thing, is like you have to be able to forget how crappy you've been in the past in order to be competent in the future. Like, I think Bryson Stott's OPS starts with a 7 now, which is kind of nuts considering how awful he was to start the year. And, like, yeah. They've just been chipping away and chipping away. And, you know, I don't think that this Phillies lineup is as good as some of the ones that we've seen in the past. And it is pretty reliant on Schwarber and Harper. That being said, like, they're good. They're a good,
yeah.
good lineup.
Stott, not quite OPS over 700, but still way too close to Vlad Jr. for anybody to feel comfortable. That said, the Phillies, who are they chasing down? The Atlanta Braves, who dropped a series over the weekend in San Francisco. The Braves won this opener. Hurston Waldrop is back. That is exciting for them. Reynaldo Lopez is maybe also being stretched out. So that felt like a good start to the weekend. But then the Braves' bats just go totally quiet. Logan Webb is incredible on Saturday. He has been unbelievable for about 6 weeks now. Is he going to work his way back into the Cy Young conversation? Probably not, but credit to Logan Webb. He's really turned it on since the middle of May. Rafael Devers hits 2 homers, and then Robbie Ray shuts down the Braves on Sunday. Chris Sale's throwing 99 miles an hour, striking out a bunch of guys, but the Braves do not hit. Giants win on Sunday, which means that the Braves are only 3 games ahead of the Philadelphia Phillies. They do not play again until they play 7 times in early September, so we won't see them face each other, but at this point, I mean, 3 games with half a season to go, why not? With how the Phillies are playing, with how banged up the Braves are, I guess this is a real race in the NL East.
Austin Riley, I am worried. I am worried about Austin Riley. OPS is 627. He's under contract for the next 50 years. Moving forward, Jordan, who'd you rather have, Austin Riley or Rafael Devers?
Oh, man.
Two 29-year-old corner infielders.
And honestly, the right contracts are, I think Devers is making more, but it's not that different. Devers, I think. But also, obviously, Devers isn't playing third base anymore. Riley, in theory, could still provide some value still playing third base. But I'll take Devers because I'll always take Devers. But that's a good question. I'm worried about Riley as well. Just last thing on these two teams. So I got my power rankings coming up tomorrow. I mean, the Phillies have been playing better than the Braves for a while now. I think I'm still going to keep the Braves just a spot ahead of them, but the Phillies have climbed all the way into the top five. I'm putting them ahead of the Yankees, I think. And I even 2 or 3 weeks ago, I put the Phillies. Even before that, I think I'd already put them into the top 10 because there were so many other uninspiring teams. And where do the Cubs fit into this conversation? Do you think they are also – I have them up there in this group of top 7 or 8.
Sure, but they're below these two. In my mind, when I look at the National League, I see a top 4, not a top 5.
Okay.
I see Dodgers, Brewers, Braves, Phillies, Gap, Cubs. I think it is how I would delineate it. Now I would put you could say Dodgers group of 3, then the Cubs, but I think the Cubs are a tick below these other teams just because of the injuries that they've, accumulated over the course of the season.
I agree, and I also think the Cubs are kind of in their own tier right now because I feel better about them than St. Louis and San Diego and Miami and Pittsburgh and Washington.
Yeah.
But you're right. They do still feel like a good ways behind Atlanta and Philadelphia, even if they're not that far behind them in the rankings.
An underrated part of this Phillies era of baseball is this organization's ability to keep their pitchers healthy. Now, I don't know if that is luck or chance or strategy, or it has to do with the way that they, do work. Like, it could be like workload stuff, or it could be they're acquiring players that they view are not as injury prone, or it could just be random chance, right? But if you look at the difference between those two things, you look at the Cubs IL, that's the rotation. Ben and Brown, Edward Cabrera, Cade Horton, Justin Seale, Jameson Taillon. You look at the Braves, that's, I know Waldrop just got back, but that's Schwellenbach, Strider, AJ Smith, Shaver versus Waldrop. Like, the Phillies, their pitchers do not miss time. They're starters. They just don't, right? And that means that adds up over the course of a season where it's like, okay, the best version of the Braves and the best version of the Cubs, are they better than the Phillies? Maybe. But like, you got to evaluate the team that's on the field. And I think that we are at a point now with this Phillies group where it's like that medical staff, whatever the hell they're doing, is unique and singular in our sport. Because even like the position players like rarely miss time, right? Mm-hmm. And that has allowed an organization with dangerously little depth in the upper minors over the last couple of seasons to avoid that being a problem compared to the Royals. Like, would you take the Royals top 10 or the Phillies top 10 players? He's like closer than you think, right?
Well,
but it's like, closer than you think.
I know what your point is. Yes.
What I'm saying is like, when you keep your guys on the field, it goes a long, long, long way. The Phillies have some things to figure out. They would be a perfect landing spot for a guy like Taylor Ward at the deadline.
Ooh, yeah.
They're running Gabriel Rincones out there in a corner. He has not really been impressive to me, but all things considered, this Phillies team, it's as if they didn't spend April pooping their pants. They're just like back and everything's back to normal.
Was Rob Thompson watching the Phillies over the weekend or Team Canada? What do we think?
Or was he grinding tape on Kansas University prospects, high school kids for that program? Because he loves being a Jayhawk. He was rooting for Algeria, obviously.
Because Rock Chalk Algeria. Great point.
Rock Chalk Algeria.
True. Wow, you'd be so confused for about 1.5
Canada versus Algeria. Who does Rob Thompson vote? Who's he rooting for? Tune in on the next episode of Baseball Barbecast. The question that everyone's wondering.
Let's stay at the top of the National League here with the Dodgers taking 2 out of 3 over the San Diego Padres. Roki had a bit of a clunker. Hey, shouts out to Walker Buehler, who's kind of been pitching really well for the San Diego Padres.
Yeah.
He throws well against his former team as they win on Friday, but the Dodgers bounce back with a blowout on Saturday, which they really needed. especially with some big homers from Kyle Tucker and Dalton Rushing. And then Emmett Sheehan, a big bounce back outing on Sunday. He's really been going through it lately.
Yeah.
So nice to see him throw it well. And Ohtani did not homer. He's still three away from 300. But other than that, I think this was still a successful weekend in San Diego for a Dodgers team that, you know, they like to win in San Diego for sure.
I would like to propose a new segment called Yes, Crying in Baseball. As you know, Jordan, I am one of the bigger proponents of having tears stream out of the face. I love crying, love a good cry. We had some Roki Sasaki crying on Friday after he walked the farm. Good cry, bad cry. So, is it fair for us to evaluate people's emotions in this way? Who can say? But as someone who is pro crying, I feel more comfortable to do so. How do you feel about these tears?
I don't know. We've seen Roki have this face where it looks like his eyes. We've seen this a lot, like many times with him, to the point where I'm kind of just wondering if just like that's how he looks when he is.
This is how I disagree. This is the most distraught and emotionally tattered.
We've seen him look this way many times. I disagree. We've seen a version of think about how many awful outings he's had. So I guess my point is I'm not 100% convinced that we had liquid going on here. I'm just not.
Because you don't know if there was liquid.
And that's why I can't say for sure that this. There have been
I
more
disagree,
convincing
dude.
Ones.
There's liquid under the eyes. People don't sweat here.
That's
got to be tears.
I'm not even. Again, we've seen him where I've been like, yeah, no, he's definitely welling up, and it's fine. Listen, I'm not opposed to us.
Here's
talking
my
about
Roki take.
Baseball. I just this one sure. I'm not as convinced by.
You don't know if this was crying, and I think that is do your own research, listeners. Go see if this was crying for yourself. I would say this. I think Roki Sasaki needs to kind of dive into music. I think music in the emotional, what's the word I'm thinking of? The emotional fallback, the emotional like outlet that music can provide will give Roki the opportunity to be emotional in other settings. You know, like I think he should just go get a quick cry and put on some, Bon Iver or some heavy metal and just get emotional by his lonesome. I think that would be a nice pivot for him. I think he has these emotions. He doesn't know how to, get his emotions out. And I think music could be the vehicle for that. So Dodgers, I know you've thought of everything. Buy Roki Sasaki an Apple Music subscription and let's go from there. Other series over the weekend. Astros taking 3 out of 4 over the Tigers.
Whoa,
Astros just a touch back.
Well,
yeah.
Okay. I was going to say, you were skipping past Guardians Mariners, but I guess we can come back to that one. Here's the thing. I did want to mention this one because I'm trying to follow our order on the sheet here. And sometimes we leave series behind. I've seen this before. I've seen this movie before. I've seen this turbo mode before where we fly past the series. We don't talk about it. So I'm trying to make sure we don't do that. Mariners, you're being spared. Just because the rest of the American League is an embarrassment doesn't mean that you should be flying under the radar to this degree. However, this weekend was a tough look for the Mariners of Seattle once again. I was only there for one of these in person, but regardless, credit to Cleveland, who's now starting to get healthier. Chase Lauder is back. That was good to see. And they got Cooper Ingles up in the big leagues, Khalil Watson. The Guardians are fun to watch on offense. Their pitching is pretty solid. That's another team that's managed to keep their pitching healthy in a pretty impressive way, at least in the rotation. Slade Ciccone's starting to figure some stuff out. But as far as true talent level, like you still look at the Mariners roster and it looks better than most of the other teams in the American League. And now here they are under 500. They've squandered their first place position. And is their season over? No. But boy, they are climbing up the list of teams that are as disappointing as can be. Sure, they're not at the bottom of the standings like the Tigers.
They're holding
the Red Sox and Mets. But man,
we're not
as
golf,
far as wasted opportunities.
Yeah. They're just shooting par and waiting for the back nine. Like that's what the Mariners are doing. They're hoping they get hot down the stretch. Is that exciting? No. But it is better than a team like the Tigers, who are racking up double bogeys on the front nine. They lost 3 out of 4 over the weekend in Houston. And every single Tiger series at this point that they don't win is big news. because it just adds to they will they trade Tarek Skubal conversation. Mm-hmm. It heightens the likelihood of that. They are now the second worst team by record in the American League, below the Angels, above only the Royals. They are officially running out of time. Reds take 2 out of 3. Over the Pirates in Pittsburgh. The Pirates have now lost 8 straight Paul Skeen starts. He's allowed multiple runs in all those outings, which he has not been bad. Like, he's not like bad at pitching now, Paul Skeens. It is bizarre that they're just not giving run support to the guy that's their best player. Paul Skeens, who hit in college, put him on the mound or behind the put him in the batter's box. Let him hit when he pitches.
The those two losses on Friday and Saturday were really, really, really bad for Pittsburgh and making me just not come on, Pirates. You still have this like positive run differential that makes you look better than all these other mediocre teams. But I don't know. You watch games like that and you're like, nope, same old Pirates. But hey, let's talk about a good baseball team, the Chicago White Sox, who won 2 out of 3 over the Kansas City Royals. The Royals had a bullpen game disaster on Friday. White Sox win 22-3. 22-3 in a baseball game. The then they come back the next day with a ridiculous rally in the bottom of the ninth. If you did not see what happened, I almost don't even want to spoil what happened if you did not see it. So I would encourage you to go watch the highlights of what happened in the bottom of the ninth on Saturday. Certainly not if you're a Royals fan. But if you're basically anybody else, you should go watch what happened at the end of that game.
Or if you get queasy when you see people get hit in the nuts, I would also stray away.
Yeah, maybe that would also be stay away.
Royals avoid the sweep on Sunday. I'm just excited to spend some time around the White Sox this week just to get a sense for like how real this is. Obviously, me taking a look for 2 days is not as conclusive as a season of results. But just to get my hands around that team. It'll be interesting to do. Marlins, 2 out of 3 over the Cardinals. Marlins are one of the hottest teams in the sport. The Cards have kind of come back to earth a little bit. We got another 7 scoreless innings from Max Meyer, who wins again, undefeated through 17 starts. Marlins win the bullpen game on Saturday. Gusto, King, Backer, Bender, Zuber, who says no, put it on a t-shirt. Otto Lopez, his batting average up to .336. Cardinals avoid the sweep on Sunday. Let's finish up. Twins over Rockies. If a Twins-Rockies series in late June falls in the forest, does it make sound? Apparently it does on this podcast. Hunter Goodman had 3 home runs on Saturday. He now has 25 home runs, 18 of which are away from Coors Field. I believe that his 28-5 home runs are tied for second in the entire sport. Only Kyle Schwarber has more. He's tied with Buxton and Yordan at 25. He's going to be the Rockies All-Star, as he should be. Proving that last year's breakout was no blip. Hunter Goodman is good at this. The Twins, though, they won this series, and they are now 2 games back in the American League wildcard. I've given them 0 thought, and I think I honestly will refuse to do so until they are in a wildcard spot.
That's important, though, because Joe Ryan is, I still think, going to get traded. So how painful that is, depending on where they are in the standings, I don't think Twins fans would necessarily be shocked if and when that happens, but just something to consider. That's all the baseball. We did it. Another Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Colin Brennan for producing. Thank you to Sam Blum for joining us for his Baseball Barbacast debut. We'll be back on Wednesday, and I think we're just going to keep on talking about baseball. Hopefully that's okay with all of you. Talk to you then.
That's fine with me.
See ya.
Goodbye.